Well, I guess I might as well start. I'm Terry Saverin. I'm not very practiced at doing this. I only do it once every 50 years.
Forgive
me. When I walk around the village, it looks about the same, but everything is different. The work that I did a long time ago has been redone, but it still looks pretty much the same. The experience that I learned at Holden, it probably helped me more in my various and varied career than my formal educational training. And I love to see, you know, the new projects and the new faces working on the old projects. I think the first position that Holden should have established would have been that of scribe, a person who just objectively records everything that's going on here, the dates, the names, the projects, the scandals, the priorities, the trends, the fads. You can imagine what the size of that journal would be today. Saturday, I talked about my first few summers here, beginning in 1963, and the first winter I was here, 1965 and 66, where I ended up being here alone. During that time, I was finishing the hydroelectric plant on the inside and getting the village ready for the first staff coming in that summer. They came in about May 20th. I talked about the huge avalanche that hit the village, taking out the power lines and filling a couple of chalets with snow. And I related the unique anecdotal experiences I had being here by myself, and the interchanges I had with Oscar Getty down at Lucerne, the old pioneer of the area, and Gordon Stewart, who lived for 60 years up at Donkey Lake in a cabin, or more like a hovel. It was quite interesting. Every generation here has its unique experiences, happy, traumatic, meaningful. And by generation, I don't mean 33 years. It could be a summer, a year, 5 years, a decade, or all of those. I certainly don't claim that my years here were the best years, because I know they weren't. Many times when I've returned here, I've thought, oh, I wish I were on the staff now. But I had experiences here that no one else probably will ever have. Today I'd like to kind of pick up from where I left off and discuss the general programming in the 60s, and as I remember it, and some of the work projects that started or continued on. I think I have lots of help in the audience here, or critics at least. So please feel free to chime in whenever and ask questions. 1963 was the first year of programming under the executive director, Carol Hinderle. The prior director, Gil Berg, a retired businessman from Seattle, was named Holden mayor. Gil got the physical plant back into habitable shape. Carol, on the other hand, established the soul of Holden's philosophy and mission, making it one of the most significant retreat centers in the world. Even though Carol wanted the staff to be involved and go to the various presentations by what was then called the faculty, now it's the teaching staff, for many of this wasn't an option because we were working up on the dam or in the hydro plant or, you know, chopping wood or up on a power pole or whatever. So we didn't get the opportunity to go to some of these presentations by, you know, great people. But I got to know a lot of them outside of the lecture circuit. Carroll was a visionary and a theologian. He was earthy, he had a humble egotism, was mercurial, creative, fearless, controversial, stubborn, and sensitive. Yeah. He brought holy hilarity to the village. His wife Mary was a scholar and theologian in her own right. She shared an office with an aunt of mine at Augsburg College, where they both taught English. She was Carroll's alter ego. Many times she would, from across the dining hall, when he was proclaiming something on the microphone, say, "Oh, Carroll, that's not true."
"Or that's enough."
"What?"
"Or that's enough."
Werner Jansen became the business manager at this time in the 60s. Werner was on a staff, assigned to the kitchen. One day, Carroll, during announcements at noon, proclaimed that Werner was going to be the next business manager, the new business manager. Werner came out of the kitchen, and his head was bright red. He was sort of baldish, and it was just bright red. Well, this was news to him. But he accepted it and stayed here for over 20 years. When Werner left, he was replaced by four or five people. 1963 was the first year Beanie and Gertrude Lundholm came from Augustana, Rock Island. Beanie was the musician for many years. He played the piano in the dining hall. Every bus load of people that came into the dining room at noon was greeted with everyone singing H for high, "We're glad you're here." The Beanie sings were legendary, happening at the end of every noon meal and every evening meal. Beanie also played the carillon every morning, waking everyone up before the bell for breakfast. Gertrude was the hospitality queen. She invited all new guests to their chalet every Sunday for coffee and discussions after the morning service.
And that tradition continues.
Yes, right. Rudy and Doris Edmund came from Rock Island also. Rudy became the village geologist, and Doris was renowned in children's programming and development and started Narnia. They ultimately contributed the money that built the Holden Museum, which is going to be torn down now. My remediation. I came with a theater group of 12 from Augsburg College. We did four plays and repertory in the unheated village center. We were here for 2 weeks, and then we left for 2 weeks when a group named Camp Farthest Out had their own retreat. Then we came back for another 2 weeks. They had their own programming, and they didn't want any theater people here. The only control for the fire siren was a switch outside the back door of the kitchen, painted red and mounted quite high so it wouldn't be accidentally turned on. When the siren was activated, everyone was supposed to go down to the schoolyard. There was no love lost, really, between Gil Berg and Carol Hinderly in 1963. Sort of like, who's in charge here, you or me? The sauna in the old garbage building behind the hotel was one of the first things done under Carroll's regime. He would also take a sauna in the middle of the day, and frequently he would come into the dining room dripping wet with a cigar in his mouth to make the announcements. He would ramble on and on in his own style. One day, Gilbert had had enough. he unobtrusively left the dining room and switched on the siren. End of announcements, end of lunch. Back to work. Carol slowly built the teaching staff over the years, first calling on his friends like Fritz Norstedt from Luther Sem and Howard Hong from St. Olaf. 1964, I returned doing theater again, but at the same time I was getting involved in the village work around here. My first job was taking all of the radiators out of this building in preparation for making it what it is today, or what it was then. It's changed more than any building here at Holden over the years. Craft classes began in the basement of Chalet 7, and pottery started in the upstairs room of the schoolhouse. The hydro was worked on and went into limited operation on August of 1964. Arnold Flotten from St. Olaf became the first village artist carving the altar. Among the other faculty were Norman Hobble from Concordia St. Louis, George Farrell, plus Elmer Witt, Joe Bash, and Merton Strumman, all theologians and youth leaders in the various synods. 1965 brought the first snack bar, and the diversion dam was started. Howard Hong, the world's authority on Kierkegaard, in a philosophical way, dedicated the renewed sewage system and drain field just east of the schoolhouse. It was the first Christmas in July. The piano in the dining hall was really out of tune, having gone through freezing and warming temperatures for years since the hotel was not used during the winter. So I decided to tune it. I wrote to my dad and asked him to send me a tuning fork, a hammer, and wedges, which he did. I'd never tuned a piano. It was a lot more difficult than I had expected. But I guess it was better after I had finished. Beanie thought it was, but he was beginning to lose his hearing. It prepped me for building the Zuckerman harpsichord a couple of years later, which was much easier to tune because it only has one string. It was the first year that Paul Hain was here. He was ordained in the Missouri Synod and taught economics at Valparaiso University. Carol and Paul instituted the first Pan-Lutheran communion service with members from the LCMS, ALC, and LCA. Prior to that, separate communion services were held here. Mm-hmm. 1966, the library went into this building, Koinonia. Carol arranged for Japanese oak floor to be donated. It was shipped free by a Norwegian shipping line, and the boat company didn't charge for it to ship up lake. Carol was very proud of that. Howard Hong built this fireplace, and an auction in the dining hall raised enough money for the huge hood, which was used over, which is no longer here. In subsequent years, that was removed either because it sucked too much heat out of the building or because of air pollution in the valley. I don't know. Does anyone?
Yeah, it sucked up the air. And it also, when we started worshiping in here, the sight lines, you couldn't see across the room either.
So right, I wouldn't be able to see you.
Crickle, crickle.
After it stopped being used, it sort of got in the way.
Yeah, right.
The smokestack was still here until a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
closed
right.
Up.
Yeah, it was just about this big around.
Yeah.
And The hydro was dedicated that year by the minister from the church in Ohio that donated the $4,000 for the initial cost of the hydro. Werner was married and spent the 1966 winter in the village. We were in Chalet 1. It was not an ideal situation for a newly married couple. For many reasons, not least of which was Werner's responsibilities to the community, which was me. And Judy was very young, and she was expected to be the cook. I think she was 19.
She was 18 or 19.
18 or 19 when they got married. Mm-hmm.
Did she know what she was getting into?
No.
No.
No. Surprised her.
No. No. There were times when I'd come down in the morning and Werner was cooking breakfast, and I thought, aha. There's been some talking. The first large snowmobile was purchased.
So were you and Werner and Judy the only people here that most of that winter?
Well, basically.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Basically. Walt Olson was here a while, in and out. The snowmobile was built in Sweden and had a Volkswagen Bug engine mounted in the front of the snowmobile. And a Bug, they're mounted in the back. So the shifting pattern was in reverse. I kind of grew up in a Volkswagen, so I had to kind of relearn.
Just got a photo of that.
And the village had a fundraiser.
Pass that around.
That summer of 66 was my first year here. And they had, what are the names of the little car toys? The
Matchbook.
There was a replica of the snowmobile. And I remember I donated $100 to the village for that little snowmobile.
Right.
And for me, that was a big deal. $100
was a lot of money.
Right. It was named Maximus because it was in honor of Max Orlo, who Max and his family came up here. He was an engineer at Boeing, and they came up here just as a family, and they skinned all these logs for the railings in here and all the timbers. But one time, Eleanor, Max's wife, and their three girls came up here, and Max stayed in Seattle, Mercer Island, where they live. And Max had rented a motorcycle, a motor scooter or something, and he was driving around Mercer Island, and he went off the road and was killed. And it was pretty tragic for the community. Anyway, this was the first year for winter guests also. I remember a lady came up here at Christmas that year all by herself, and she was sort of a timid sort of person, and I felt sorry for her. I took her out snowshoeing, and she kept tripping and falling on her face in the snow. So Christmas Eve, I gave her a little sculpture of two welded snowshoes. The only other guest I remember that winter, we had more, but I can't remember who they were, but the other one I remember was one of the board members, Jerry Dobley, and he came up in the spring. He and Werner and I snowshoed up to Holden Lake, and Jerry had brought with him wine that came in little cans, a little smaller than a soda can. He brought like a six-pack of canned wine. And I thought that was really cool, so we had that up in the sun on Martin Ridge.
Did the Gillings come that early?
No, I don't think so. one winter, Judy and I and Werner went down on the snowmobile to Lucerne and hiked up to Dompy Lake to see Gordon Stewart, who had been there for 50 years at this time. He had no electricity or running water in his hovel. He had the carcass of an elk hanging on his covered porch there, which he had shot 6 months before, 5 months before. It was covered with kind of a scum. And when he wanted to eat, he would kind of scrape the scum off and then cut off a piece of the meat and cook it. We brought our own lunch. And an apple pie. When we left, Judy said to Gordon, you can have the rest of this pie. And Gordon said, you bet, you're not taking that with you. Prior to eating lunch, he wanted to play chess. And I said, sure. He beat me with a fool's checkmate, which I think is three moves. I haven't played chess. back to the program in 1966 through 70. During these years, Carroll recruited the leading scholar on the Reformation, Roland Bainton from Yale. And Roland, besides being a fabulous lecturer, very entertaining lecturer, drew caricatures of people around the village. And this is the one he did of me. There was also Rosemary Ruther, a leading Catholic theologian from Howard University. Carroll knew he was pushing the envelope by having a Roman Catholic on the teaching staff here. He was a bit nervous before she came, but it turned out to be a pretty meaningful dialogue.
As long as everybody else watched her kids.
I guess I'd like to point out that we have recordings in our audio archive, and we are preparing for our audio archive of many of these sessions that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So over the next couple of years, you'll get to hear from these very same people.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're recorded on a wax cylinder, right?
Yeah. They were recorded reel-to-reel originally, but we're digitizing them for the web. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. The Lutheran theologian Martin Marty was here during that time from Chicago. Norm Hobble from Concordia St. Louis staged the play Jeremiah that he had written, besides doing his lecturing.
I was in
Tom. You were in it?
I was in it.
Yeah.
What did you play?
Part of the chorus or something.
No, how old were you?
It was in the children's chorus.
I was probably like 9.
Oh, wow.
Norman Hobble was the person that somebody asked me once why I put me on hold, and I said it was Norman Hobble, and it happened to be he was in the village. It was his. He was his lectures on Genesis and creation that just blew me away in 1966. And I told him what I told this guy on the bus, and Norm went, "Oh yeah, that's when I began to get in trouble with the church." He ended up in Australia and
yes,
India.
He was from Australia originally.
Mm-hmm.
Art in the village became more and more common. There were many sculptors and painters, among them John Mockestead from St. Olaf, Betty Olson from Minneapolis. And I taught metal sculpture periodically during this time. It was the wonderful, turbulent 60s. And even as a place apart, Holden grappled with the issues that were going on out in the world. Black theologians, Will Hertzfeld and James Cone, challenged many people coming to Holden. I had great talks with Ginny Whipp, Tom's mother, about the black movement in Chicago. Ginny knit me a sweater that I wore on every climb I did in the Cascades, Rockies, Italian, Swiss, and French Alps. And I still have that sweater. It's my wit knit.
And I have a sculpture that Terry gave her in return for that.
It was the hippie era, and Holden wasn't immune from some of that culture. Drugs here?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe some marijuana. I'm not sure about
other
drugs that might have been happening.
I read in the book up there that the director asked quite a few of the help to leave.
That was Fritz
because of that reason, and then said, if you want to come back clean, you can.
That was Fritz Norsted.
Yeah.
In about 77.
That was later, yes, yeah.
But Carol invited a family from Minneapolis in the early 70s, a black family, to come and be on staff. And they established themselves in Chalet 4, I think, and immediately attracted a group of staff, and they had a lot of marijuana, I'm sure. I don't know what else they had.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol was not here then, and Werner didn't really know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the day after Carol arrived, they were up. They didn't come to Vespers. They just had a little click falling around them.
Yeah. Well, tell your story about the guys on mushrooms.
Oh, well, that's...
It's not really related to Holden, but
no,
I think it's kind
of
an interesting...
There's just a couple of hikers up at Suyal Pass. Somebody was hiking through and discovered these two guys nude, running around their campsite, hallucinating. And they ended up being helicoptered out to. Somebody here is a mushroom expert. Are you in the room, the mushroom guy?
Me.
It was you.
Yes.
You said probably that it would have worn off. It wasn't poisonous. But anyway, they were helicoptered out to Carmody or somewhere.
And of course, there were heated discussions about Vietnam and prayers for peace. It was women's liberation time, just as Joanna Holt.
You want to know about that? Talk to Joanna.
Yeah.
Right.
After I'm finished, otherwise. You know. And that year, the bookstore opened. 1966 through 70 winters. Each winter, more people stayed on the staff. I think up to about 20 when I was here. And more guests came, of course. Since we had a nurse in residence, Margaret Felt, Werner reached out to an old resident at Instehekin at the head of the lake, Paul Bergman. Paul was about 80. And was originally from Switzerland and was divorced from his wife and estranged from his daughter. He had some medical issues, and so it was helpful for him to come up here and have a nurse to take care of him a little bit. He had a small shop in Stehekin where he sold handcrafted wooden boxes and clocks, sort of in the style of Swiss ornamentation.
But mainly he had photography and he did tinting.
Right. He tinted black and white photos, which he had taken years before. And he, this is I had two of his. This is one he gave to me. It's an upper Lyman leg. And it's got the original upper Lyman Lake cabin here, which when I was here was just the remnants were just kind of the rotten floor, barely visible. So this was probably taken in the 30s or 40s, I would guess.
He was really interesting. He was from Switzerland, and he had left Switzerland because he couldn't bear the thought of having to fulfill the role that his family expected of him. So, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, I sort of remember that.
Yeah, he told me about that one. And he ended up up in Canada in an Indian reservation. He was a pretty interesting guy. Very delightful person.
And I think Holden might have facilitated something between his...
Reconciliation with his daughter. Mm-hmm.
His daughter, yeah.
Yeah, he and his daughter became reconciled.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another cabin, I guess it must have been the replacement of the one you're mentioning,
the
women of
Lyman,
that we would go through in the 60s. And there was a logbook there.
That was a Laura Lyman.
That was Laura Lyman, yeah.
Lower Lyman.
There was
yeah.
a Laura Lyman
yeah.
cabin, which was really well fitted out. It had a couple, it had bunk beds and it had a wood stove in there.
It had a wood stove, and we mistook the oven for the fire pit, so we built a fire in the oven and filled the place with smoke.
And the mice joined us.
And one year,
day and night,
we decided to make some candles. And we used for wicks. I don't remember the whole thing, but anyway, the wicks burned up.
Mm, yeah. And it was used for the snow survey during the winter, primarily. Not primarily, but it was used for the snow survey. So there was a tall post, about 20 feet tall, outside of it with a shovel on the top, so
yeah.
that when the snow survey guys came through, they could shovel down into it and get in there. But it really was a pretty, you know, it was convenient to have that and sort of luxurious in a way, but all the way around the cabin, it was just awful because people would, you know, cut down the little trees and use it for firewood, and it was all tromped down, and it was not very nice around there. But there was that cabin, and there was also one at Heart Lake, right across the stream as you got to Heart Lake. There was a cabin over there.
West went to that one time, first time and last time that I knew that he hiked, and some young fella convinced him to go with a rope with us down, and he went down to that.
Oh, really?
It was kind of dilapidated.
Right.
But that's the only time I know that he left the village to hike.
Yeah.
And he was okay at it, a little slippery without the right shoes. But.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. During this time, all the meals during the winter were in Koinonia here. We all sat at one table that and the kitchen was over there. And the food was good. It wasn't like the first winter I was here. We had venison, we had bear, we had beaver that Gordon Stewart gave to us, which was delicious, actually. Besides the standard fare, it was pretty traditional cooking, though, meat and potatoes. Not at all as creative as the cooking is now.
Never had a salad.
Pardon?
No salad or fresh fruit.
No, because it was hard to get stuff up here then.
Where did you get the bear?
Hunter.
You did?
I didn't, but yeah.
Didn't Joe want
somebody noticed it?
Yeah, Joe. Actually, I after he'd skinned it, I was going to make a bearskin rug. So I had found this old book on how to do that, and I made a fleshing pole, and I used an old saw blade or something to scrape all the fat off the hide, and I just soak it in acid and you stretch it out and let it dry, and then to keep vermin, bugs and stuff from getting into it, you sprinkle arsenic into it. And one of the staff went out, and happened to be going out, and I said, would you get some arsenic? She could just go to the bug store and get arsenic. And she brought it back. And
did you complete the rug?
Yeah, but it kind of shrunk up on me. But yeah, I took it
did
back.
Did you have it up
Minnesota.
In your room?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I kind of remember maybe that.
Yeah. There was one time when the milk came up in like boxes and the liner, and there was one time when it all soured. So they made cottage cheese out of it. Mm-hmm. Nothing went to waste. There was a range of ages here during the winter for the first time, from 1 year old to 80 years. In 1969, a disaster happened. Chalet 2 burned. Three of us were up in the mechanics garage working on the snowmobile. The siren was sounded, but we couldn't hear it because of all the snow on the roof of the hotel. And
there were three people down here only. There were six people in the village, right?
Yeah, I think so, and I don't know why that was, but
everybody went out after Christmas or something.
Yeah, one of the staff women, Ardell Irick, ran up to the garage, trudging through the snow, and she was not the most athletic person. She ran up there, bursting in the garage, telling us it was on fire. And we jumped into the snowmobile and just tore out of the garage, went up that snowbank right outside the garage, just tore out of there and came down here, and it was just fully engulfed. And I ran to the lower firehouse here and dug down into that, pulled out the hose, hooked it up, turned on the valve, nothing. So I ran up to the next firehouse, and we dug down in there, and we were kind of frantic in a way, and Joe Walmer, who was the kind of operations guy, said, I can't do this. I think I'm going to have a heart attack. And I said, okay, I'll do it. You just don't worry about it. I'll do it. So I dug down in there and hooked up that hose, turned on the valve, nothing. Then I realized the water tank was empty. But I knew there was a bypass valve on the hill up above the hydro ways that took the water from the hydro line into the domestic line. So I tore up there with Jim Skinloff, who was one of the other workers like me. And I knew about where it was, but under 5 or 6 feet of snow, you kind of lose your perspective. So we dug down in one spot and hit the ground, and there was no valve box there. But I knew it was close. And so I said, let's dig this way. So we dug over a few feet, and there it was. And I, turned on the valve, and probably within 30 seconds, there was, water down here. But by that time, it was, too late. There was a lot of snow on the roofs of Chalet 1 and 3, so because of the intense heat, that was melting, and water was just pouring off of those roofs, which saved those two buildings. But it was a pretty depressing evening here. And I know what the cause was. An Ashley heater had been put into the living room of that chalet, and
it was occupied that winter.
Yeah, it was occupied. And they're notorious for overheating, and it just kind of exploded and caught fire and set the whole place on fire. So, children and families have always been an important aspect of Holden. Eventually, the Holden School was established, and that was after I left. In the years, that I was here, there was a hose from the upper firehouse that let water into the drainage ditch all along in front of the chalets, and 24 hours a day. And kids played in that drainage ditch all the time, building little dams and little bridges and making stick boats and sailing from the top of the hill all the way down. And
Shasta cans.
Shasta cans.
We floated Shasta cans.
Yeah. It was a great activity there. And that all had to end when the water started being treated here, because it would just be too wasteful and expensive. So maybe with the new water system, do something like that.
You didn't mention Rich Kemmerer as one of the artists.
Well, yeah, I forgot about that.
Wasn't until the
70s. Rich.
The job obviously wasn't until the 70s.
Yeah, Rich was an artist, and he taught at Valparaiso University, and I took a class from him at Valpo, and I mentioned Holden Village to him because I'd come from here, and he was very intrigued by it. He hadn't heard of it, so, and I left Valpo, and subsequently he did come out here, and he painted the ceiling of the village center, and he then went on and formed the Grunewald Guild.
An art retreat,
an art cage
retreat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually,
pretty modeled after Holden. Yeah, pretty
modeled after. Yeah,
so there were three communities, because the pictures in Chicago, and Paul Keane tried to put one together in Seattle that didn't ever materialize. But I understood that those all happened about the same time, Grunewald and pictures and
yeah, they
also.
Did.
Mm.
The guild worked because they had spent so much time here, and they really patterned it after that only on art and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to be in Europe with Liz, his wife, when she gets a postcard that says, "Well, dear, we just put money down and we're going to have the Grunewald Guild, which will be patterned." So we drank wine and celebrated. Liz goes, no.
Yeah, I haven't been there. I'll close with a little anecdotal image for you to ponder. There was a particular time where there happened to be about six young boys, about 7 years old, in the village. And they were like a pack. They just did everything together, just kind of moved around, did everything together. At the end of one day, the large flatbed truck was left outside the village center right here. And this pack of boys had apparently skipped Vespers. And when everyone came out of Vespers, they were greeted with this pack of boys standing on the bed of the truck, seeing who could pee the furthest. Tom, were you one of them? I thought you were. So that's all I have to say. do you have any questions?
I just want to add additions. Some things aren't our questions, but for Carol Hinderly, the whole idea of laymen being introduced to theology was extremely important. That was the focus of the program, and it wasn't just theology, but it was across the whole gamut of creation and geology and art and literature and music and all of that, which made the village so unique. But it was the notion that it was a place for the lay people to come. Carol often said he just loved it when a pastor came and you couldn't tell it was a pastor. But that was the focus, that was really the focus of the program. It's just, and that's what grabbed me when I first came here.
Well, I have the understanding that so much of what's here in part got modeled by his years in the other place.
That and they were in Scandinavia, and
it was the European retreat
center. Folk schools model was part of it in Denmark.
Right, yeah.
Although Carol used to say the first summer he came, he felt like he was in prison camp again.
Still there.
Because the dynamic between he and Dilbert was so difficult, I think.
And the mountains always kind of constricting for him?
I mean, from the Midwest. The mountains, yeah. He was in prison camp in the Philippines.
Didn't he also take work campers to France? I mean, didn't he take work campers to France? I thought he had done some work camp stuff, and that's where the notion of the work camp program came from.
Was he on the Baton Rouge?
No, he was a missionary.
He's been both German and Japanese prisons.
Not German prisons.
No,
I thought they were captured, or not captured, they were detained first on their way to Africa.
No, they were on their way to China.
And then they were detained by the Germans, but then released, and then way to the Philippines and back to the end. That's the impression I have.
No, I think
just the Philippines.
Not a hinderly in the house to verify.
Yeah, Martin was my classmate at Augsburg, and she was born in the prison camp.
She was there.
And I heard tell the first time she cried was when they were liberated. Because she had, it kind of trained her not to make too much noise.
Mm-hmm. I think the lay concept is really important and doesn't surround it here in some ways, but still it does by the kinds of theologians he was able to get here and that they carried on. And then he began looking for lay people who had a theology. I mean, it took me 3 years to convince him that I had an advanced degree and fitness was my thing, but that God's creation demands that we use our bodies right. And he bought that, and then I was here for many summers. Now, I'm not sure he bought all my feminist views, nor do I. But it was an important time for the laity, I think. And then moving to the congregations and the importance of congregations coming and going back out, and he was really always after us about going back out. Mm-hmm. The only thing he really enjoyed about me was that I was a great volleyball player, and he thought he was, and we played, ask Tom, very competitively in volleyball, and left holes when the ball fell to the ground.
It was called the Holden Village move, because if three people were there, so it would be the three synods watching it.
Yeah, right. I was Augustana.
Yeah.
But it was important for us and for many of us for years and years, because, I mean, my whole life changed because of this place. Plus their prayers, I am sure, gave the miracle of vision to me. I believed in it. They were doing it for a whole year, all through the winter, for my vision, and I still have it. And better, really, than it had been.
Carol Hinderly is daughter-in-law told me a couple of years ago that this hearth is in a circle, so that everyone who comes to the village has an equal position in the discussion,
mm-hmm.
and that it was purposefully designed for discussion.
And if you see pictures of the early sessions, I mean, I still have a problem with us being in a semicircle, and I mean, it was always the complete circle
mm-hmm.
with the speaker sitting
yeah, mm-hmm.
there
that's right,
or somewhere.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I wish they'd bring the chairs all the way around.
Yeah.
Well, that's easy.
Part of the reason is that the screen is starting to be used.
That's true. The screen
There's
is.
There's the
yeah.
screen
yeah.
and the fire code, and the fact that the altar is often up here
yes.
during half the year.
Yes.
So.
That's, yeah, and that's okay.
It's,
mm-hmm.
I was just going to add the comment that in addition to empowering the lady, and 50% of the lady was women, and long before we, I think, feminism was talked about as a subject, it was lived. I mean, the legacy of Mary Hinderly's scholarship,
mm-hmm.
the conversations I started having with Karen when I first came. I remember a moment just watching Gertrude Lundholm sit on a stool, and she was as big as a wren, and it just getting so involved
mm-hmm.
intellectually, and was every bit on par with anybody else who had lots of letters after their name. So the empowerment, I think, came that way even before sort of the identified conversation. That was very formative for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you mentioned Rudy, and I remember him very vividly, you know, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us a little bit of what happened with him here in the village and what happened afterwards? He was retired, I think, already when he was here at that point.
No, he came from Rock Island, but he then subsequently became president of California.
No, he was
Dean of California Lutheran. And he was instrumental. He and Werner and Leo Bustad. Were instrumental in starting the first Science and Technology Committee here. And they had this idea, they go up to Donkey Lake and rent a boat and fish. And they just started thinking about science and technology and stewardship and in the valley and that sort of thing, and education. And so they formed the Science and Technology Committee, which has grown and grown and grown and has become a major voice regarding the physical infrastructure of the village and resource in some cases.
And we should have mentioned Leo Bustad.
I know, I forgot. I'm sorry,
years.
I forgot.
He was
yeah. When I first met Leo, it was 1963, and at that time he was director of the radiobiological laboratories at University of California in Davis. And then he, after that, became the dean at Pullman in the
School of Veterinary Medicine.
Yeah,
he did really important research on cancer research on pigs. He developed a miniature pig. He used to come up with a cat that I love pigs.
Uh-huh.
And he gave, he was a beautiful theologian. I mean, he was really a theologian,
mm-hmm.
as well as a scientist.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, his daughter, Karen, who I identify with, but she was a good friend. She died in Africa.
In Africa.
He was, yeah, he was amazing.
Tom?
Question about this building.
Uh-huh.
When you were ripping it out. I mean, this was Lodge 5, right?
This was just like all the other dorms.
So was it wasn't in any worse condition? Was there a reason that this was chosen as to become the learning center? I mean, was it in a master plan somewhere, or you just said, oh, let's pick this one? Or?
Well, that I don't know, because I really wasn't ever really involved in planning or long-range planning. I was just sort of, you know, one of the worker bees.
Mm-hmm.
And
probably its location.
Just
yeah.
location.
Yeah.
It was probably location. That's my guess. Yeah.
It was picked early on.
Yeah.
Somebody told me that this
this building was partially gutted in the,
already
right away in early years, is that true?
Not that I, no, because I remember taking all the radiators out of every single room upstairs. I mean, it was just like, you know, one of the dorms.
Was Wes Preeb always here in those early years, or
well,
was that only later on?
Well, no, he wasn't. Well, he was sort of a presence, but he would sort of come and go.
In the early years, he wasn't so much. It was kind of like, okay, you got the gift. He wasn't embraced.
But he was here with you that clear.
Well, he was here for part of that.
He would jump in.
But not like in the later years. It was
At some point in the 70s, I think Carol or somebody, one of the directors, probably Carol, let it be known that he wanted to be sure that Wes always had a place here.
And he was given a small permanent stipend for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and he did move to Chelandra in the winter. He died in Chelandra.
I went to his service, as many other people did too, but his family said this had become his family.
He was from Western South Dakota.
Yeah.
Did any of you know him other than some of us?
Oh, yeah.
He was sort of.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, sort of laconic. I don't know what the word is. What do you mean?
No, we never
As we go through the paths of life,
we didn't know if he was a genius
or just crazy.
A little of each, probably.
As I understand it, he and Carol used to have theological discussions over the pool hall with their cigars.
Probably.
Evenings.
Yeah, Wes has an interesting story. He and Fern Olson, who was a volunteer head of housekeeping, they were going somewhere. They were in Spokane, or they were going to Spokane or something. And they stopped at this place for dinner, and Carol ordered a pitcher of beer, and they all got kind of drunk. And Carol took off across this field driving the car. Wes told me.
It was well known that Wes had well cured apple cider up in his room.
Which was room 13 in the hotel?
Room 1.
Huh?
Room 1. It's 13 now, maybe.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Room 1.
Okay. Well, it's that end.
That end, yeah.
They changed the number. Okay.
Tom Witt, who's leaving, was here in first 1962.
He's one of the ones that was up on the flatbed truck, right?
No, he's not.
Stepped on my toe.
That's probably his brother Paul.
You started to say that food was sort of pedestrian at the beginning. So were you going to say then there was a change? And
well, the other day I talked about the food I had here that winter and how cases of eggs were shipped up in the fall and just put on the back porch of Chalet 1 all winter long. So by spring they were really stale. They were just, they weren't rotten, they were just stale. And the meat was from the chest freezer up in the hotel, and it was like these institutional roasts that were, and since power had gone out because of the avalanche, they'd partially thawed and then were frozen, and they were just so freezer burned beyond belief, and I take them down to the carpenter shop and put them through the bandsaw, cut off a chunk, and it was like eating shoe leather. And they're all I had were like number 10 cans of vegetables and from the hotel.
Which were nasty to start with.
There were apples that were shipped up by an orchardist that were kept in the hallway of the hotel down below. And they were pretty good. They shriveled up by the end of the winter.
Were there avalanches while the mining company was here? Because I thought this was chosen.
Oh yeah.
Well, was this just the least avalanche?
Well, this is a really freak avalanche that happened, and I'm not sure. It must have happened during the mining days.
But the avalanche path between the village and Winston Camp, they had school patrols.
Right.
To patrol the children with that particular. And when I was here, there was an avalanche that came down that. It was right by the where the garbo is, and crossed the road once.
Yeah, there's an outcropping up above the village here that makes any of the snow that comes down and go this way. And, but the one, like he said, it was just so big or whatever it.
And it came right through the woods, and it just pushed the windows out and chalets 10 and 11. Filled those rooms with snow.
I'm a novice here. There's a number of names I hear repeated, the Hinderlicks, where we have multiple generations of leadership. How often does that happen?
Only two generations. That's the only time.
The Hinderlicks is the only time when we have two generations of leadership.
Well, other than Elmer Witt was here early on, and he became a director, and now we've got Tom Witt here, who's doing music, so there is.
But he's not.
He's not.
In the village.
No.
But
he has a career.
But
Dusty,
I would argue
Dave Christian was a cook here, and his son is a cook here.
That's the delight. So maybe they're not going to be directors, but the kids that have grown up here and are now, you know, we're playing in the water, and now are putting your meal on now. You know, it's just been wonderful to see that.
John Wallace, now, I don't know if he has this year, but has lectured on economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had been a student a week of Paul Hain.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Different philosophical notions about economics. But
John Crowder.
Right. And he had his couple of his kids gone. That guy, too.
John Wallace?
Yeah. And he was a grandson, but he lived here for many summers.
Thank you.
He was only 40.
Thank you very much.
If you were here anytime between 73 and 78, these two are.
So,